You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Hundreds of anti-war protesters were arrested today in Midtown Manhattan after blocking Fifth Avenue near Rockefeller Center for almost 3 hours, jamming intersections and chaining themselves together. Members of M27, a coalition of anti-war groups, staged this mock die-in to symbolize Iraqi war victims. Jose Santiago, news director of Pacifica Station WBAI, was there at the scene.
I'm standing here at the corner of 49th Street and 5th Avenue, just near the entrance, the main entrance to Rockefeller Center. And in the last 2 minutes or so, at least 50 that I could see, possibly more, people have broken out of the penned-in area that, where the police had herded people since about 7:30 this morning. And they are now lying in the street. They have blocked traffic on 5th Avenue, which, as you know, at this hour is one of the most congested traffic avenues in the country. The traffic already going back many, many, many blocks. Riot helmeted police are now standing over the people who are lying on the ground. They are beginning to grab them and in some cases yank them up pretty vigorously. I've seen about five or six people already dragged off, and they're pushing us back now. And I see clusters of police conferring with their officers, trying to determine exactly how to handle this. And they are slowly but surely picking people up and dragging them away to waiting wagons.
WBAI News Director Jose Santiago, one of the organizers of the protest, Mark Milano from ACT UP, spoke to Peace Watch from a New York City holding cell shortly after he was arrested.
Of course, we're angry at Bush and the government, but we're also incredibly angry at all the corporations that are going to profit from this war and the media that is profiting. You know, anytime there's a war, CNN's ratings go way up, and it pretty much just feeds the people whatever the government sends them, pretty much without question. So we were targeting the media government and the corporate war profiteers. That's why we chose Rock Center and Midtown Manhattan.
Well, when you say that the media's ratings go up, does that not have to do with the people eager and interested in seeing the coverage? Is it necessarily a reflection on the network and their programming?
Yeah, but the reflection on the network is the fact that they don't report the truth. They don't tell us what's really going on over there. They just, we learned from the first Gulf War, they were completely just spoon-feeding everybody what the government said, and later on we found out that the smart bombs were not very smart, that there were actually over 200,000 Iraqi civilians killed. None of that came out during the war because the media aren't doing their job, which is to be skeptical, questioning. So we're saying to the media, you are helping this government promote this war. We also want to send a message to New Yorkers that you are not going to be allowed to go on with your daily lives while people are dying in Iraq. We're going to disrupt your life, too. You're going to sit in traffic for an hour. You're going to have to, go through some hassle because life will not go on here as usual while people are being slaughtered over there.
Did someone come down and speak to the demonstrators or the protesters from the organizations that you were performing the die-in in front of?
There were tons of media there. There were cameras from, I believe, every network and every newspaper. So there was a tremendous amount of press coverage. And remember, this protest was just organized on last Sunday evening. So in 4 days, we've got hundreds of arrests, thousands in the street. As a person with AIDS, I'm very aware that he is planning on making major cuts to Medicaid. While he is putting billions into the war, he is cutting back healthcare services, all the other issues, education, the environment, the economy, are being either ignored or gutted by him while we are all distracted by this war. That's the message, too. Let's oppose the weapons of mass distraction.
Does your campaign include perhaps contacting some of these media organizations and organizations that you say are war profiteers to have some sort of dialogue, a discussion?
No, we're taking direct action right now. There's been enough talk, enough nice little protest marches. We're up in the ante. We're disrupting. We're getting arrested. We are angry as hell. So, no, the time for talking is over. People are being slaughtered. We're taking to the streets.
Mark Milano, one of the organizers of today's anti-war protest in New York City. The New York die-in symbolized the real deaths taking place each day in Iraq as the U.S.-led invasion exacerbates civilian deaths and refugee crises. But as Peace Watch producer Robert Knight discovered today in an interview on New York Pacifica station WBAI's wake-up call, some human rights organizations are hesitant to place direct blame on the Bush administration for the current refugee crises in northern Iraq, which remains under the non-UN mandated control of the U.S. military and Central Intelligence Agency. Knight spoke with Allison Parker, Director of Refugee Policy for Human Rights Watch.
Human Rights Watch has a team based in northern Iraq at the moment, and they have been sending regular dispatches to us about the situation for internally displaced Iraqis. They've been in two provinces in northern Iraq. One is Sulaymaniyah province, and the other is Arbil province. And in those two provinces, our teams have estimated that there are as many as 40,000 internally displaced persons. Now, these are people that actually live in the north, but have evacuated from cities and other places where they felt they might become subject to attack. The other number of internally displaced in the north is about 2,000 people who managed to cross from government-controlled Iraq. And these people were coming from places like Kirkuk, Mosul, Tikrit, and even Baghdad. What's happened, though, and something that's of serious concern to Human Rights Watch, is that since these some 2,000 people were able to reach northern Iraq, the government has shut down many of the checkpoints. And so people are no longer able to flee, it seems, which is a very serious concern from a human rights perspective.
Is there not concern in the northern region in particular because of the militarization from the invasion of United States paratroopers, of the ongoing operations of the United States Central Intelligence Agency, its relationship with anti-Iraqi government Kurds, and the presence of Turkish troops, much less the Iranian Mujahideen who are present there? Is not the covert preparations for this war a refugee problem-causing factor in the north of Iraq?
Well, the north of Iraq is a place where we already have several factions operating, as you've mentioned, and really a potential for ongoing insecurity, obviously, in the middle of a war. One of the elements that you just mentioned is certainly one that Human Rights Watch has been extremely concerned about, and this is the potential presence of Turkish paramilitary forces in the north.
Has Human Rights Watch also condemned the presence of the United States in northern Iraq?
We have not condemned the presence of the United States.
Why not?
Human Rights Watch is an organization that, in order to maintain our access to areas and our ability to comment impartially on violations of the laws of war, which is one of our major goals in covering this war.
You said that you're concerned about the Turkish involvement. Are you equally concerned about the U.S. CIA and military involvement?
We would certainly be concerned if we saw, for example, any United States military targeting civilians, not offering sufficient warning so that people could get out of harm's way.
Like in Baghdad.
For the moment, we are not aware of the United States not offering a warning to civilian populations to get out of harm's way.
You mean like the 15 people killed in the Al-Shaba suburb of Baghdad yesterday?
If you're referring to the attack on the marketplace, we were extremely distressed to learn about the deaths of civilians in this war, and we will certainly and will call for an independent investigation as to whether or not that was an appropriate target. At the moment, on the facts that we have, it seems unlikely. However, there have been reports that there were military installations in that neighborhood, so it's really something that has to be weighed.
A mile away.
If that's, actually,
a mile away, according to Robert Fisk of The Independent in today's edition.
Right. Well, in those kinds of situations, one has to look at the very egregious case of civilian death and weigh whether or not that was an appropriate military choice.
Is the United States invasion contributing to the difficulties of refugees in Iraq?
Of course. Any war that creates will create human displacement, and we've already seen it in these thousands of people who are trying to reach places of safety.
Allison Parker is the director of refugee policy for Human Rights Watch. She was interviewed by Robert Knight earlier today on WBAI's Wake Up Call. Human Rights Watch warned Turkish authorities today against repeating past violations in any operations it might undertake in northern Iraq. In a letter sent to Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the group recalled gross violations committed in the 15-year conflict in southeastern Turkey, although the conflict with the Rebel Kurdistan Workers Party, or PKK, essentially ended with a unilateral PKK ceasefire in 1999. Little has been done in Turkey to hold accountable those responsible for the abuses. The Turkish parliament voted last week to send the country's troops to northern Iraq from the Turkish capital Ankara. Aaron Glantz has more.
Thousands of cheering unionists crowd onto the busy streets of downtown Ankara. The teachers, doctors, architects, engineers, and public sector workers' unions are at the forefront of Turkey's anti-war coalition. The unions have organized a one-day national work stoppage to protest the war on Iraq and Turkey's participation in it. Under intense public pressure, the Turkish parliament refused to allow the American army to launch an attack on Iraq from Turkish soil. But the parliament did grant the United States the right to use Turkish airspace to bomb Iraq, and in the same motion, the parliament voted to authorize the Turkish army to invade Iraq at the direction of the head of the Turkish army. Adnan Golupnar is a member of the Administrative Council of Turkey's Teachers Union, ETIMSEN.
I think Iraq's territory is united. If it's united, I think we should respect it. No other countries should intervene in its unity and integrity. If there are internal problems there, they can be resolved by its own people.
The possibility of an independent Turkish offensive into northern Iraq has sparked alarm in Washington, London, and Moscow, in the offices of the European Union, and at NATO headquarters in Brussels. Kurdish leader Masoud Barzani has promised to fight if the Turkish army invades. The possibility of Turks and Kurds at war with each other in northern Iraq represents a nightmare for the Bush administration, which wants to avoid any quagmire in its war to oust Saddam Hussein. In an effort to assuage such concerns, the head of the Turkish army, General Hilmi Özkök, held a rare televised news conference in the southeastern Turkish city of Diyarbakir.
We won't enter northern Iraq in order to attack it or invade it. We don't want a permanent presence in Iraq. Our aim is not that. Our only aim is to supply aid to the people there, as we want to extend a hand of friendship to the people in the area.
Many observers don't buy that, though. Enders Büyükşehir is president of the Ankara chapter of Turkey's Human Rights Association.
It's not realistic to believe a military member talking about friendship and peace.
The United Nations estimates 400,000 Kurds have fled their homes in northern Iraq's major cities, seeking shelter in the mountain villages on the Iraq side of the border. Iran, Syria, and Turkey have all closed their borders to these refugees in violation of the 1951 Geneva Convention, says Levin Korkut, director of Amnesty International's office in the Turkish capital, Ankara.
In terms of international law, according to 51 Convention on Refugees, there is a fundamental rule, principle, non-refoulement. That means countries should accept people who are escaping from their governments or regimes. That means the borders should be open, and countries, all the countries, not Turkey, should accept refugees inside.
Korkut says Turkey, Iran, and Syria are also refusing to allow humanitarian aid workers into northern Iraq. As a result, he says, food and fuel shortages are reaching a crisis stage. Korkut adds there are no major human rights groups operating in northern Iraq. And with journalists barred from crossing the Turkish-Iraqi border, news reports on the Turkish troops' activities are rare. Turkish authorities want to prevent a Kurdish state in northern Iraq, and many observers also believe the government in Ankara has its eyes on the oil-rich Iraqi cities of Mosul and Kirkuk, promised by Britain to Turkey's founding president, Mustafa Kemal, at the Treaty of Lausanne in 1923. Untapped oil reserves near Mosul and Kirkuk are estimated at more than $10 billion. Again, Anders Büyükşehir of Turkey's Human Rights Association.
Like most governments who have racist, militarist, and invasionary mentalities, our government starts to drool, but they cannot say this explicitly in front of the public, as there is a great opposition to the war and racism in Turkey, just like in the rest of the world.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz with Ezgi Sertaş in the Turkish capital, Ankara.
When most Americans think of Iraq these days, images of war and destruction leap to mind. In the media, we see images of Iraqis demonstrating their support for Saddam Hussein or images of malnourished children standing in war-torn streets. One photographer decided to show America a different side of Iraq. Gabriella Bulasklova put together an exhibit in collaboration with six other photographers, which attempts to bridge the gap between Americans and Iraqis by displaying the humanity and diversity of the Iraqi people. Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian spoke with her about Faces of Iraq.
During a Cold War, there was a delegation of U.S. citizens who went to Soviet Union and who photographed ordinary Russian Soviet people, you know, children on the streets, in schools, teachers, doctors, and they brought the images back with them to the United States. This delegation was able to show what was not shown here before, that the people in Soviet Union are not the enemies, that they're ordinary people, you know, that they look like us, feel like us, that they could be our neighbors. And that is one of the usual tactics that governments use, is to dehumanize, you know, the enemy, the so-called enemy. And once we start putting faces on these people, you know, we start relating to them. And then it's very hard for us to allow for the government to cause suffering, you know, to them or to label them enemy anymore. I went to Iraq in May of 2002 and brought with me some images back. And then I realized that my images were not enough to show the incredible diversity of the social fabric, of diversity of, you know, Iraq and Iraqi population. So I approached other photographers and asked them if they would be willing to contribute their images. And what happened now is an exhibition, photography exhibition called Faces of Iraq, that features photographs of seven photographers who had the opportunity to travel or to stay for a longer time in Iraq.
So who are the faces of Iraq? What are some of the types of people that were photographed?
Mm-hmm. They are ordinary Iraqi people. They are, you know, people like you and I and our neighbors, our family members. There are people who I encountered or who other photographers encountered in the markets, you know, on the streets of Baghdad or Basra or other Iraqi cities, people in hospitals, you know, women who are spending their time in hospitals with the children, their doctors, their school teachers. They are, you know, watermelon salesmen. They are, you know, ordinary people. Before I went to Iraq, I actually saw some images from Iraq, but what I saw were images of you know, tragically suffering Iraqi children, malnourished, you know, children with diseases that was impossible in Iraq to cure. And it was extremely hard for me to look at those images. And yes, I did encounter that in Iraq. I saw, you know, suffering children in Iraqi hospitals. But that's not what I wanted to bring back. I wanted to bring back, you know, something what people can look at and relate to, and something what could begin and a dialogue, what could bridge people in Iraq with the people here in the United States.
I know the first time that I saw pictures mm-hmm. of just people out in the streets of Baghdad going about their daily lives, that mm-hmm. it had a very different effect on me. Mm-hmm. Coming back, you know, and you've shown these to people, what type of effect have these images had on, what type of response have you gotten from people at this exhibit?
Mm-hmm. There's a quote that I like to mention, and it came from Vietnamese women, because Vietnamese women were amongst the victims when the United States went into war with Vietnam. And they said, "Bombs are terrible, but we still have our song." And, you know, that song represents something what I was trying to also show in the images, is the daily life. You know, precisely that although, you know, you wake up in the morning and you might hear a siren, you know, announcing that there is an aircraft carrier above them. You know that there might not be food on a table, that there is no, you know, drinking water available, that you cannot help your child or your neighbor's child, you know, who is in the hospital. There is this incredible strength of, you know, going on with living, just keeping with the daily life and, you know, staying alive, you know, singing the song, created the song. You know, and the images are in color and in black and white. And for me, the color brings something, you know, once again, what is not being portrayed here, you know, the colors of daily living.
It's very real. It's not just something sort of in a museum. It's, right, you know, very right, living type right. of exhibit. And do you have any particular stories of people you met taking photographs of?
Mm-hmm. I certainly do. There were occasions when I was told by people not to photograph them. And what I did, I carried with me a little flyer, a statement that was written in English as well as in Arabic, because unfortunately I don't speak Arabic. And the flyer explained what I was doing, why I was there, that I was there with a humanitarian delegation, you know, that we were breaking the sanctions by bringing, you know, humanitarian aid to the Iraqi people. And once they read it, they said, yes, go ahead and take my picture. You know, go ahead and take my picture and take the story and tell about me and about my neighbors, about the people in Iraq, in the United States.
Photographer Gabriela Bulasova speaking with Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian. For more information, visit the website www.facesofiraq.org. The Reverend William Sloan Coffin, one of the most respected leaders of the anti-Vietnam War movement, served as chaplain at Yale University from 1957 to 1975. Coffin spoke recently at Yale in conjunction with the opening of an exhibit at the school's library called Give Peace a Chance. We present now part two of that speech.
There's an adage that says, people make history when history is ready to be made. And history was ready to be made in 66 and especially 67 with the draft in the United States. Students were automatically deferred. Their consciences were bothered. Not so much that they dropped out in droves from Yale and resisted the draft, but they bothered too much not to do something. And it turns out that the draft card had a fantastic symbolic value. Everybody had to carry the draft card, anybody of draft age, on their persons at all times. And then sudden students around the country began to pull out the draft cards and set them on fire. I never liked that very much. Needlessly hostile. A lot of students at Yale were well aware of the draft cards being burned. And in the summer, two graduate students went to Cambridge, where they met with Michael Ferber and a couple of other people, and they decided that there should be a nationwide draft card turn-in in different sites all over the country on October 16, 1967. So that was laid out. And I'll never forget when Doug and Rick announced that in the first fall teaching in law school, you could see the stomachs begin to cramp up a little bit. Everybody had to decide, you know, turn in, not turn in, turn in, not turn in, because everybody had a draft card. That's why there's no draft now. Representative Rangel was absolutely right to press for it as an anti-war measure, but it will never get through this administration. Well, in the meantime, another group of people who are over the draft in age, and they questioned the constitutionality of the war and the way the war was being directed, namely war crimes were being committed for which we had written statements in U.S. Army manuals that they were strictly forbidden. All kinds of people signed the call to resist illegitimate authority. That was in circulation, and lots of us signed on, hundreds of people did. And I had quite a fine idea, namely that draftards should be collected on October 16th all over the country, brought to Washington, and hundreds of those above draft age who would sign the call to resist illegitimate authority should be invited down to make common cause with the people resisting the draft. Not avoiding, not dodging, but resisting the draft. The draft cards would be turned in with supporting statements. Now, according to Article 12 of the Selective Service Act, anybody who aided or abetted draft resistance was liable to $10,000 fine and or $5 in jail. So that was a wonderful way where the overage crowd could get together with the students who were resisting the draft. Well, we gathered on Friday, October the 22nd. We all met, several hundred of us, draft resistors and the overage type, in a Lutheran parish house not far from the Capitol. And from there, we marched to the Justice Department. There were subsequent turn-ins, draft card turn-ins, all kinds of demonstrations in Washington. As Beaumarchais said, I pressed myself to laugh at everything for fear of having to cry about it all. And I must say, it's the only way you feel you can laugh about things, because the alternative is to cry. I'm far more worried that this America that is being, looks to most of us here, less and less like our country. We may well be in danger of losing it. And I'm so glad that so many people are now rising up and protesting against the war. In the 60s, we had the leaders, and we were short of followers. Now, we have quite a following and a real shortage of leaders. But they will appear as the time demands them, I think. Certainly hope so.
That was the Reverend William Sloan Coffin speaking at Yale University on February 24th. The exhibit Give Peace a Chance runs through April 6th at Yale's Sterling Library. It is free and open to the public. Thanks to Peace Watch correspondent Melinda Tuhus for producing that segment. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.